So you are now listening to a special edition of the West Marin Matters Post Carbon and the Farm and Food Shed Report. I am your host, along with Bing Gong, Robin Carpenter, and Bing Gong, who's the host of Post Carbon, and his new co-host, Karin. And the last name is Newhouse? Nyhouse?
Nyhouse.
I'm learning to pronounce Karin's name correctly. So we're doing a special collaborative show today called The Future of Farming, and it's about the young farmer movement. And we have a variety of wonderful guests joining us. I'm going to make sure I've got everybody's mics on here. We've got a full studio going. And we're going to welcome Severin Von Tarscher Fleming. Severin is the founder and director of the Greenhorns, which is a nonprofit organization made up of young farmers and a diversity of collaborators, and FarmHack, which is an open source community for resilient agriculture. And Severin recently described herself as, "I'm an organizer and logistics girl behind the scenes, convening parties with free beer in Grange Halls, making films, doing radio, publishing books to hold the cultural voices of this movement." Welcome, Severin.
Thanks for having me. Such a pleasure.
It's great to have you. I also want to mention that we have our local farmer, Aaron Wilder, who is also an organizer here. He has Tabletop Farm here and is organizing a January Young Farmers Forum. So, Severin, I know that you met Bing Gong in New York from Post Carbon.
Hi, Severin.
Hi.
So I know that Bing was really interested in a little bit of a conversation first about how did we get here where we lost all of our farmers? If you maybe want to talk a little bit about that and segue into some other topics.
Sure. Do you want me to go or you want Bing to go?
No, you, please.
Well, so it's funny, we're talking so much inside of the young farmers community about the future and the future we want to build together. But, of course, that future is situated on the legacy of our agricultural history in this country, which isn't that long but has already swung us in a big arc. The history recently of American agriculture is one of exodus from rural America, of consolidation into larger and larger farm enterprises. As you know, I'm sure, the invention and then proliferation of factory-scale farming and genetic engineering and the chemical addiction that is predicated on. And so the character of American agriculture in the last 50 years has been changing and moving away from the kind of iconic golden image of the American family farm and more towards an industrial model. And with that has come a decrease in the number of farmers. We now have less farmers in this country than we have prisoners. Fewer than 1% of our farm operators in this country are African American. And about 70% of the farm work that is performed in this country is performed by farm workers who don't have American citizenship. So the vast landscape beyond Marin, the kind of story of American agriculture that we're walking into, the landscape we're walking onto as young farmers and young agrarians, is a landscape that has been reorganized by an era of intense concentration and kind of devolved into a system that now needs reform. And so lucky here we are with reform on our minds and our fingers sticking into the ground, wanting to build a new farm economy kind of inside this old, somewhat broken one that we've inherited. Not long enough.
That's excellent. One of the things that I know that you've spoken about before is how young farmers today are having to straddle this place of trying to have this place in nature, and often you're trying to restore the land you've gotten to work on, and that other place is having your foot in the farmer's market or the retail economic space. And what is that like? And also, you know, didn't our forefathers have to do that, or foremothers? Could you talk a little bit about that? Is it somewhat unique to you, the young farmer, especially so many of you are not having a farm handed down to you? The majority of you are stepping into farming without it being a generational handoff.
Right. Yeah. So there are young farmers who are lucky enough to be born on farms and to be able to build a business, you know, on their uncle's farm or their parents' farm or, you know, a side operation that grew into a full-time gig. And then there are those farmers who just learned they wanted to farm, you know, without having land in the family. Or, you know, as is the case in the living room last night when I was sitting around, all of us had a story of farm loss in our family. So we're talking about that concentration and consolidation and dispossession. Not only were the Native Americans kicked off the farm by white settlers, but the waves of evolution of that farm economy have, you know, have resulted in a lot of farm loss by a lot of families. So some are coming with land and some are coming without land. Those who are coming without land are also often coming without much money into the operation. So the startup of those farms, which are, yes, part of capitalism, part of the economy, part of marketplace, those farmers are often finding land that is degraded, undervalued, underutilized, marginal in some way, or you know, lucky happenstance. And so a big part of the project is capitalizing the startup, building back up the barns that maybe have saggy roofs, restoring the fertility of the soil, restoring the hedgerows and kind of ecosystem boundaries of that land, setting up the irrigation and the pumps in a way that maybe is a bit more enlightened than was original to that land, original to that land in the sense of the first generation of farming. You know, you may inherit a barn, but it might be in the wrong place, or it might not. And so, again, there's that straddle, and this is a Jeffersonian kind of a political concept that we're also talking about, you know, the yeoman farmer, the farmer who is both a laborer and a kind of petty capitalist, who straddles that economy of the mainstream and the economy of the homestead, and who is a highly sentient, highly opportunistic, highly engaged practitioner of farming and of, and his view also of politics. And so I think as we're competing at, in the you know, marketplace as young farmers selling our product mostly direct to start with, most young farmers are selling directly in farmers markets, CSAs, to restaurants, in order to capture that full retail dollar, that full dollar that we can capture, in order to pump that money back into the farm business. You're talking about a community of people who are truly engaged with their community of eaters in a way that a commodity producer making, say, corn or soy or dairy or wheat is not in touch with their marketplace. So that has a lot of advantages in terms of relating to the appetites as they shift and change of the consumer.
I think we're all aware that the average age of farmers is something like in their late 50s now, and we, you mentioned in New York City, I know that something like 400 million acres will be transferred in the next 20 years or so. And it's so important for young farmers to have access to land. I know you have started the Agrarian Trust. Could you tell us a little bit about that effort?
Oh, yes. Thanks for the prompt. Yeah. So you're mentioning the average age of the farmer is now, you know, 59, edging up. Average age of the rancher is more like 61. That is a demographic situation that means, well, it's kind of a demographic crisis. It basically means that the land stewards of this country are aging out of that job. And you got a lot of old men and ladies who are in charge of that land and who whose decisions are going to really, to a large extent, determine the future of our American agricultural landscape. As those land stewards and land owners age, the future of that land is very much in question. And So are we looking at a period of intense concentration, you know, yet more concentration, as Wall Street and investment funds are looking at farmland to kind of bolster and balance their portfolio? Will we see a financialization of farmland here in the U.S.? Or will we see an expansion of regional food economies and the kinds of operations driven by these reform-minded young farmers who are very eager to serve a more local or more regional marketplace and practice farming in a way that uses less inputs, uses less energy, creates far less pollution, respects nature, and, of course, diversifies the agricultural landscape to support the needs of the people closer by. And, you know, that's an open question. So Agrarian Trust is new. It's a new organization that is a partnership between Greenhorns and the Schumacher Center for New Economics, which is out of Massachusetts and is a specialist organization working on kind of new economic instruments. And it's founded basically in response to that very problematic context of an entering generation with educational debt and not much money in terms of farming, both from farm backgrounds and not farm backgrounds. Neither of those groups have a lot of capital. And then an exiting generation who, you know, want to cash out, retire, or are passing into another land in the sky. So Agrarian Trust is adopting a strategy that was developed in France. We're in the process now of building the legal infrastructure and the financial infrastructure to pull that off. But the project in France that we based it off of is called Terre de Lien, which means connection to the earth. And basically, it's a farmland commons. It's a cooperatively owned kind of sanctuary for local food production. In the same way you have maybe like a nature sanctuary, this is a cooperatively owned sanctuary for local food security. Terre de Lien has been around now for 7 years, and they have more than 6,000 acres of land, farmland, permanently organic, permanently affordable to farmers because it is not ever to be sold again. So there are many approaches being taken to this project of getting the next generation on the land. There aren't enough approaches yet, but there are increasingly activities in this direction. And we are undertaking this kind of pretty radical commons-based approach because we think it provokes the right questions around the commodification of land, the overvaluation of land for development or golf courses or fracking or speculation, and the fact that our economy is looking at that land with that kind of a greedy appetite and saying this farm is more valuable for those uses than it is for local food security. So Agrarian Trust is a very fun and stimulating project. I'm learning a lot about the law and working with a wonderful group of lawyers, radical lawyers of the sharing economy, who are called Sustainable Economies Law Center. They're out of Oakland. And, you know, really nose down on this legal back end until March, and then we open up. We open up the deal flow and start looking at land gifts, investments, bequests, and applications by young farmers who have some land in mind that they'd like to see protected forever and be lifetime stewards of. So, yeah, it's really exciting.
Severin, this is Karin. I actually have a question. I was at the EcoFarm conference in 2013, went to a workshop on women in farming, and what I learned was that title to farmland in the United States is held, more than half of it is held by women. Do you want to talk about what that means in particular for women to be facing this transition and what you're hearing from them?
That's a really good question, and I've actually been in touch with a lot of women landowners and landowner groups. In Iowa, there's a very strong community called Women Caring for the Land that grew out of the Women Food and Agriculture Network. There are Women Food and Agriculture Networks around the country in some states, Pennsylvania, Vermont. And basically, they started as kind of a support group for women landowners trying to put sustainable management clauses on their lease agreements. So these are women, many of them widowed, and many of them widowed by cancer, who care a lot about the health and conservation value of their land, and who may be slightly intimidated having leased that land to a nephew or a neighbor's son to stand up for their right to have that land protected from spray and poison, to make sure that it's not over-tiled and over-cropped. And as a result of these, support groups are being empowered to take that stand. Now, you know, it's not an easy proposition in the very middle of a monoculture-dominated landscape to try and run a business that sells direct. It's very much a farm-by-farm, inch-by-inch reclaiming process that we've seen in the local foods movement, in the organic farming movement, the kind of incremental organic growth, not exponential growth, of our territorial take-back of American farming. And so there are many precarious decisions, you know, precarious places on that landscape. And one woman, Lee Adcock, she's an organizer out there in Iowa. She said, listen, Severin, you've got, you know, 8 to 10 years in many of these cases to find, to match the young farmers, to match the capital, to get out here and care for this land, because these are the last women who will ever love this land, and if they sell it, it will be commodity forever.
I just want to remind the listeners that you're listening to a special collaboration of the Farm and Food Shed Report and Post Carbon Radio. Our guest at this point is Severin von Scharner Fleming, who's the founder and director of the Agrarian Trust, the Greenhorns, and also Farm Hack, and also joining us is our local farmer, Aaron Wilder. Severin, just to segue briefly back to the land issue and the French model, the commons that we have here in the United States are our federal lands. And you've talked about this before, that they're not managed very well in most cases. And we have an example in Westmoreland where we are, where farmers and people against overdevelopment and commodification of the land came together with environmentalists to have a working relationship with the Park Service. But that has not been going very well over the past several years. And we're looking to lose some of the ranches. And we've already lost an oyster farm out of the park because of environmental concerns. So in France, can you talk a little bit about, was this concept of the commons and concerned about that was taking away from maybe wilderness land? Or I see, and you mentioned too, that I think our commons of federal lands is almost 400 million acres as well. Do you see where we should be making inroads and having some political will around trying to see where there are those overlaps so that we don't have our young farmers depending on private purchase or partnerships?
Right. Well, there's a lot of questions inside there. And first of all, you know, it's a similar issue inside of the Adirondack Park, which is where I live. You know, the tension between conservation goals and agricultural goals, and trying to straddle that divide and say, you know, can we have here as a buffer around our natural areas an agroecology, an agroecological landscape that really respects the drainages and the habitat corridors and the needs of the insects, and, you know, fence in your sheep so you don't have to shoot the predators. And I think that there's, inside of the Tail du Lien project, very, very strong, I know there is very, very strong stewardship requirements, because the founding point of that project was to keep that land organic forever and cared for organically.
And
in terms of the federal lands and the state lands, yes, I do think we need to be talking a lot more about commons in general, you know, the commons of the internet, the commons of the atmosphere, the commons of our fisheries, who are in a terrible state. And, of course, in some states there have been very interesting commons-based approaches to natural resource management. Obviously, the state of Alaska has monetized their oil reserves for the benefit of their citizenry. And so everyone in Alaska gets a check every year that kind of represents their quote-unquote portion of the commons. Obviously, petroleum is of limited supply, but, you know, there's interesting models in different states where there are state-owned lands, you know, municipal-owned lands and prison-owned lands and lands that surrounded old mental health facilities. And increasingly, while we're working on a piece of legislation in New York State right now, pushing the state legislature to put a requirement on the department, the state commissioner of agriculture, to lease those lands out for beginning farmers so that the state itself recognizes the value of, first of all, local food production, second of all, sustainable food production, and third of all, beginner farmers, and starts to kind of incubate that next generation and, you know, become engaged on a very practical level. This is, you know, watershed lands as well. You know, there's a lot of places where we are not optimizing our land use in this country, and I feel like provoking this discourse inside of the commons-based framework is very helpful in terms of owning our collective responsibility, if not the land itself.
One of the things that you've done in the Young Farmers Movement, and I know Aaron can speak to this as well, is looking at this combination of agrarian values and principles and connection to the land, but combining that with technology and innovation, as well as really good solid science like soil science that's showing appropriate grazing and good farming can sequester carbon and all these great things can happen. And maybe you and Aaron could talk a little bit about how your movement and the young farmers of this movement, you're bringing something new to the table that wasn't there during Jeffersonian times.
Yeah,
I've been talking a lot. Aaron, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I could talk a little bit to that. Just as a practitioner, daily on the ground, just about every time I plow the soil, I think about what is happening to the soil that I'm plowing and what is being lost, what can be gained, what are some of the environmental factors around that, and it's a major concern of crop farming, especially the preservation of the resources that are there, and not only that, but the just creating a beneficial and long-lasting, stable, vital, and ecosystem there in the soil, and providing a lot of ways that not only the soil is protected for forever and improved for the duration of the agriculture that's happening there, but that all the other factors are included in the project, like wildlife corridors and preservation and wise use of water. Like Severin mentioned, back in Jeffersonian times, that there wasn't the technology around irrigation, and now we have much more precise ways of irrigating our land. And even though it's to some farmers consternation because it's a little bit more frustrating to use drip tape or something like that rather than overhead irrigation, we can conserve vastly more water than in other ways of irrigating. So that's just one example. I this year, because we're in extreme drought here, I've been very careful with the water here and noted that we were able to, on our farm, cut the water use by 50% and increase the yield by just making more effort towards paying more attention to the crops by double. We doubled our yield this year on the same amount of land. So there's a lot of different ways that we can manage the land.
Yeah, I see. Having a small farm, you're able to pay much more attention to those details than an industrialized farm where the
correct, yeah.
it isn't. They don't have the time to really spend.
Uh-huh.
So, Severin, one of the things that you've mm-hmm. talked about is, you know, there's this way in which the young farmer movement is using technology as opposed to, and we sort of cringe at technology when we think about, you know, bee drones and all the things that, you know, giant agribusiness is doing. Can you talk to a little bit about how the young farmer movement in many ways is made possible because of things like Farm Hack and those elements that have made you able to sort of step forward and do something that no one's been able to do? I mean, I'm a child of the, you know, the 60s co-op food, grow it in your own backyard and then burn out by the time you're 30. And, you know, this is now a whole new generation and you're really utilizing and sharing ideas. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know that's something that Aaron's worked on as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is the approach. It's how we're approaching our youth of the tools and of the technology. And actually, we're going to print tomorrow with our new Farmer's Almanac for 2015. And the theme of the almanac is agrarian technology. So we've got 120 contributors writing essays about restoration agroforestry and restoration hydrology and kind of the logistics of distribution and all of the different parts of our relationship with the tools we use and what they mean and kind of the relationship that we have with those tools. Obviously, the precision and possibility of your tools is really contingent on your understanding of the environment that you're operating in and, of course, shaped by your values as a producer. And so in Farm Hack, a lot of the project is building value not by selling your intellectual property, but building value through your own kind of virtuosity, inventiveness, and collaborative capacity, and building tools that benefit you and benefit others that you share it with online at the Farm Hack, you know, site, benefiting from collaborative sessions with, you know, old timers with white hair in their farm shops, and of course benefiting by saving labor and managing soil health and saving time on your own operation. So that's a completely different context for technology than a top-down model where a technology, particularly a spray, say a poison, say Roundup, in conjunction with the genetic engineering, which is kind of developed in a lab by a corporation and then deployed across a vast landscape. Compare that to this more iterative, spontaneous, improvisational, and, you know, deeply collaborative development trajectory of the electric tractors. A lot of these Arduino soil sensors and water sensors and temperature sensors that are being used by farmers to shut off their poultry fencing and know if their, you know, animals are in hot wire or not, or to know when the greenhouse needs to get opened or irrigated, the kinds of useful tools that help simplify getting on and off implements. I'm talking about the triangle hitch. So in terms of the metallics and the mechanics, in terms of the electronics and the kind of sensor stuff, in all of these spheres, it's really about the approach.
And also the communication, and Aaron, you can kind of talk about that, because you did have this gap of you guys have sort of risen up from the grassroots and stepping forward, and you don't, most of you don't have a background of I'm a fourth generation rancher or farmer. So you've been able to, you've had to fill in the information gap and the passing on of knowledge gap. Can you talk a little bit about why that was made possible in your generation's lifetime and some of the uses that how you guys sort of discovered that? Because I remember watching with the Young Farmers Guild here and watching that kind of unfold.
Yeah, I could talk to that a little bit. I know that from my experience when I first started, I thought I knew enough to get the farm going and to operate it consistently. But whenever anything broke, especially when it came to mechanics, I didn't know exactly what to do. And it's very expensive to go down to, haul a tractor somewhere and try to get it fixed by a tractor mechanic. So I went knocking on doors in the neighborhood, actually, and talked to different people that I knew who knew how to fix tractors. And specifically, a man who lived around the corner from me has a love of old machines, and I was extremely lucky that he was able and willing to help me work on the equipment, and not only that, but to really optimize it and make it work for me in the way that I needed it to work. So that's one example of just intergenerational communication and community. Just really reaching out to people in the community who might not be farmers but might have a background in knowing how farm stuff works.
Actually, there was a great community thing around at the Aaron. It was your tractors, right, for the Western Weekend
Parade. Oh, right.
So this was very funny. This was like the old timers and the young handsome folks. Aaron very graciously allowed us to use his vintage tractors in the parade we created for the farmers market and the farmers. And for some reason, the battery in one went down and then the other. And so I think it was one of the officers, the sheriff's officers, were going, here's what you do. You push it and you pop the clutch. And it was only someone our ages that had funky old manual cars knew about pushing and popping the clutch. So actually that was performed in front of like a huge throng of people.
Hundreds and hundreds of people
in the parade. we're demonstrating old technology meeting the young farmer.
And as we got the tractor started, everybody was clapping and everything, and it really felt like just another day on the farm.
So Severin, that's part of what you guys are trying to help out with FarmHack, right? Is to have that aggregate that information.
Yeah, and the intergenerational knowledge transfer is such a huge part of it. Obviously, as young farmers, we're like sponges, gossiping and inquiring and poking our noses into every corner to, figure out how to do stuff, and figuring out the kind of social skills to be able to interface or approach. See, there I am using technology words. how to build relation with our elders who have strong knowledge of these simpler technologies. That are much more cost effective and much more reliable often. So upcoming in California, we have two farm hack events. One is up in Mendocino at the Ranch of the Golden Rule. It's a focus on growing ethanol or making fuel alcohol from wine grape, like from the seeds and the skins of the wine grapes. And that is on the website and in January. And then in March 13th in Oakland, a focus on hyper precision with irrigation and helping different market growers map out their own irrigation plan, and then kind of strategizing with a couple of young open source hardware companies who are entrepreneurs that have really built their products through the FarmHack community, helping them kind of kit out those farmers as well as improve their own product. So there's, again, like a really deeply collaborative open source approach to developing a product that suits the needs of the grower in situ and in community. So those are two FarmHack events. You can go see them online, farmhack.org. They're usually mostly free, but potluck.
I just want to remind the listeners, you're listening to a collaboration of Post Carbon Radio and the Farm and Food Shed Report. And our guest currently, pardon me, we have Severin von Scharner Fleming, founder and director of the Greenhorns and of Farm Hack, an agrarian trust. We also have with us Aaron Wilder, who owns and operates Tabletop Farm, a 4-acre organic vegetable farm in Point Reyes Station, and is organizing our January Young Farmers Forum. And Evan, are you there? I'm just checking on the... Hi, great. Evan is joining us. Evan Wigg is the founder and organizing of our local regional Farmers Guild, which is, as you guys describe yourselves, the newest generation of farmers, ranchers, chefs, artisans, and sustainable food system advocates. Welcome, Evan.
Hey, Evan.
Thanks for having me on.
Great. So, anyway, I'm just going to let you guys, I think, Bing, you may have a question for the guys in Severin now that we have all of our sort of activist grassroots organizers on.
Well, welcome to our two-hour special, Evan. I wanted to ask you, tell us a little bit about the Grange. I think you have seven up and running in the state now, right?
Yeah, I think you said the word Grange, but we're Farmers Guild.
Oh, Farmers Guild. I'm sorry. Yes.
It's an important distinction to make. So we've been working with the Grange, which, as Severin pointed out earlier in the show, is some of the earlier grassroots agrarian movements here in America. And the Farmers Guild is essentially sort of a rebirth as inspired by the original mission of the Grange. 150 years ago, folks started getting together in small communities in rural America to create a center for civic society within the agricultural community, a place for regular, everyday people who are making their livelihoods off land to get together and organize and create their own culture, create their own political organizing unit, a place to collectivize the culture of the agricultural communities, which back then were just, a lot of them were just beginning to start and form. 150 years later, agriculture has changed quite a lot, as Severin did a fantastic job of explaining. We've gone from very small, smaller family farms all over America to just a small handful of incredibly large agribusiness companies that are continuing to conglomerate. But at the time, 150 years ago, the Grange folks were getting together for very similar reasons, which were to, at the time, fight things like the railroad monopolies that were taking advantage of small landholding family farmers. Today, the landscape is very, very, very different. But as you've heard in the last half hour, there's been a lot of young people getting back into agriculture from a very different perspective, not simply because they were born into it, not simply because of tradition, certainly not because they want to make a big buck, but because they're interested in growing food, in reforming the food system, creating an alternative to what they've grown up in.
Evan, I was just going to interject that what's interesting is the Grange was founded right after the Civil War, when so many of the men were dead. The farms were left to the women and daughters, and agriculture and those lands and farms were in a place of upset, and the country was very divided. So it's ironic that we've come back to a place 150 years later, and you guys are stepping up, and it's meaning a lot more women. And as Severin was saying, a lot of the women are widows, and we are in a state of great disarray and disagreement about, you know, do we want to live in a post-carbon world that's healthy and safe? And so I thought that was very interesting when I realized that's, you know, that we've kind of come full circle in a way, or spiraled up to the next spot somehow.
Yeah, well,
right.
And our land
definitely
is still what unites us. I think that that's the real potential for this new agrarian movement and land-based work. You know, following the logic of the landscape and in the context of community, having sovereignty and having authorship of what happens in our home places and in our economies, and citizens feeling like they can engage. You know, we as young people who happen to have chosen farming are obviously one constituency, but I mean, across the post-carbon kind of universe, there are so many different communities who are rising up and envisioning a different future for us.
And Severin, I actually was really grateful that you brought up Native Americans, African Americans, when you first started talking, and I'd like to bring that back into the conversation now, that as young farmers are trying to sort of take back land and take back farming, What are the opportunities to build social justice into the new farming landscape, the new agriculture landscape, and who's doing what around that now?
Yeah, again, just yesterday we were recording songs, traditional Grange songs from the 1860s and 70s in the Grange Hall in my little town in the Adirondacks. It was the Keysville Grange. And, you know, we wandered outside the door of the Grange and ran into a woman who's a historian, and she said, well, you should know that right across the street from the Grange was a major depot in the Underground Railroad, and the passageway north to Canada to freedom of African-American slaves escaping from Missouri. And, you know, that kind of legacy and lineage of rural solidarity, you know, rural, mostly white in the North Country of New York, solidarity with the plight of these enslaved people who, you know, were the economic engine of our country to a large extent. You know, cotton was the biggest export of the United States for more than 50 years, and that was land stolen from indigenous people and, of course, grown and hoed and harvested and picked by hand until, of course, the cotton gin by enslaved African-American people. So the issue of restorative justice and access to land for non-whites in this country is really challenging because so much of the power and wealth and land is in the hands of the winners of history. And of course, the challenge of making a living in small-scale agriculture is challenging enough with, you know, a liberal arts education and the confidence to take a big risk because you know you could, you know, step out and get a winter job, you know, teaching school or coaching or doing conservation work or writing grants or, you know, pursuing other white-collar job that can kind of bolster you as an entrepreneur in a field that really doesn't make a lot of money. Having that, not having that kind of advantage makes starting a farm business incredibly difficult. So a lot of the issues around farm workers becoming farm owners and rural youth, people having access to enough kind of personal and familial prosperity and security to be able to start any small business, let alone a small business whose products are perishable, is a major challenge in terms of what's happening and what's possible. Yes, there is a thriving social justice portion of the young farmer movement and of the local farm movement overall. You know, it's still a minority in terms of the organic food that's being grown is, but they're especially in urban and peri-urban areas. Definitely there's major moving back to the land in the rural South. Families who did manage to keep their land in the family. There's efforts and progress underway, especially in terms of native foods, growing traditional native foods on native land. Really powerful wins in the lakes region, protecting the native wild rice and the foodways there from contamination by GMOs. Progress in the Southwest around growing the traditional beans for health of in the community. So, yes, progress, but yes, more work needed to bolster and support the work of those communities in particular.
Well, that also kind of comes back to what you were talking about, the French model and the commons, that if we look at large swaths of our American landscape that could have, you know, restorative practices and organic practices for farming, and then we look at it as the commons, then it sort of levels the playing field for access. Did you find that happening in France?
Yeah, well, and in France, another part is that they, you know, they've regulated their agricultural land. So their farmland, in order for farmland to be sold, it has to pass through a regulatory layer, which, of course, you know, is unthinkable in the, you know, private property context here in the U.S. But basically, there's a mission and there's a set of values encoded in that regulatory agency who are looking to make sure that there's adequate diversity in the region, that there's adequate opportunity for new farmers, that there's adequate opportunity for farmers of different ethnicities, and to kind of balance and regulate that we don't have so much of the power held in such a few number of hands. Again, what that would look like in the U.S. context may require another year of me studying things and other people studying things, but I think the conversation should get ripped open and you know, let's move this let local food discourse out of backyard chickens and what color their eggs are and into these issues of vast territorial consequence for our groundwater, for our atmosphere, for our freedom to breed seeds and trade seeds. There's a lot of work to be done and plenty of it for all of us to get engaged in.
Evan, would you like to jump in the conversation?
Oh, I did have a quick question that maybe you guys could address. Is Bing had brought up the fact that there is this thing, this myth, I call it, saying that we cannot in any possible way feed all the people on the planet with sustainable regional food sheds, that we have to have giant agribusiness to feed the planet. So I thought maybe that would be something also, because a lot of times the young farmer movement is looked upon as, oh, you idealistic kids, by the time you're 45, you'll know that this is silly and you can't feed the world this way. So could you guys kind of address how you're looking at that? Because that's what agribusiness hammers everybody over the head with. You may not like us, but you're going to need us.
Evan, you might have something to say about that. If not, I can speak to that.
Well, I mean, the question is, you know, the difference between access and production. I mean, not even withstanding the question of whether or not the current production models are going to be sustainable 50 years from now, but despite the fact that you increase production, who has access to that food, and who has equity into the means of that production? You have bigger companies producing more food. That might be the case. However, it continually goes in the profits of that food, that equity of those food companies continually goes into fewer and fewer hands. So you have more production of food, but it's incredibly tight in the way that it's distributed. The equity, you know, you have these farmers who enter into contracts. So just because you're producing food doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be available to people. You have one-third of all food right now goes to waste. That might be in the field, that might be on the shelves, but for whatever the reason it might be, obviously that's not a very efficient system, despite what these huge food companies might say. You have places like the Central Valley, for instance, Fresno, is producing more food than anywhere in the country, and yet they have more people on food stamps in Fresno than almost anywhere else in California.
So it's really about distribution.
Disconnect.
So I know some studies have said it's
right.
Really about distribution, that we actually are producing enough food now to feed the 7 billion coming. It's about distribution and equity. Severin, have you run across that in the work that you're doing, answering that?
Well, it just seems an important moment to mention that the massive production of commodities that we're engaged in here in the United States and the dumping that we've engaged in the last decades around the world has served to destabilize the agricultural economies of those countries, notably Mexico. But really all over the world with our food aid, we're contaminating the market with our own subsidized, artificially cheap food and calories. And that the nitrogen that we're using to grow those calories on this beautiful soil that was scraped off of Canada, thank you very much, by the big glacier onto our breadbasket of the Midwest. We're mining that soil and we're irrigating it, and or not irrigating it, it's being rained on, but we're fertilizing it with synthetic nitrogen, which is made out of natural gas. So the, you know, quote-unquote productive capacity of that system that system of massive overproduction and export and reliance on high energy inputs is, you know, we call it unsustainable for a reason. We cannot sustain it. So I feel like it's not a question of saying, you know, choose your paradigm. You know, what team are you on? Are you on this, you know, small organic, you know, small is beautiful, or are you on the biggest subsidized? I feel like ultimately we're all on the same team in that we all want our grandchildren to eat, and we have to be co-designers of a kind of like step down of the method on this agricultural landscape. And obviously incremental change of these small organic farms and medium organic farms and large organic farms is a major part of that. But I'm really interested to open the dialogue with the community of young people who are stepping onto land owned by their family and trying to navigate the decisions around that land stewardship. Those kids are currently being massively brainwashed by corporate-owned agricultural youth organizations like the FFA. I've just written an essay about this, so I'm pretty fired up about it. But again, I think we have a tendency to polarize ourselves overall in this country. But in terms of our land use and decisions being made at a policy level that determine what kinds of businesses and what kinds of crops and what kinds of local economic context these next generation farmers have to look forward to, unity and discourse and I think being in touch with history and the future in a more realistic and holistic way is a needed process.
Well, I think maybe Aaron and Evan can also speak to that, because I know in our area, as we've watched all the dairy basically become organic because that's what people wanted. And I know, you know, we do have the dynamic tension between conventional farmers and organic farmers and transitioning and holding the space to not seem judgmental, but to welcome them over, and then how the consumer plays a big part. And that's what you young farmers are doing. You guys are really connecting to the consumer.
Yeah, and there's a paradigm that's the industrial model that kind of says we grow for this anonymous market out there, and then there's another paradigm that is more on a small scale local basis where we say we actually know who we grow for. I mean, I personally know almost all the people who buy from my farm, and there's a few hundred people, and so that network there is a very important network, and maybe my farm doesn't meet all the nutritional needs of everyone, but paired up with a lot of different producers in the area, I've talked to a lot of people who actually say that they almost for all of their nutritional needs actually are met in West Marin or in the county, and that's saying something. That's saying a lot, and I think that there is a shift in the notion that our food comes from somewhere very far away that we can't, you know, we don't have any connection to, maybe the Central Valley or maybe somewhere in, you know, Eastern Washington or Idaho or whatever, compared to I know exactly where my food comes from. It comes from a mile away or something, and I know who grows it, and so it's a process of not only seeking out where your food comes from, but it's also a process of stimulating the culture around the production of food and having more producers. And this is why we're talking about this right now, is we need more young farmers. And one of the industrial paradigm is based on a very, very small number of farmers compared to the population that we have right now. Whereas maybe if we had hundreds of times more farmers, then, you know, we would actually be able to utilize a lot more of the resources out there, decrease the waste that we're experiencing right now, manage our soil fertility, and make those connections between the consumers and the producers.
Well, one of the things that Severin, that you touched on, and it's something that we feel here, I think, in West Marin and Sonoma in our food shed. We have a wonderful president of the Marin Farm Bureau, Sam Dolcini, and Sam and I always have this dynamic tension conversation about, you know, conventional farmers and that, you know, they listen to what the consumer wants. And, and there have been times when the consumer says, we want this, we want that. But then regulation gets passed. They have to meet it. But then the consumer buys the cheaper product. And, you know, so there's this tension about what are the kids learning. I mean, almost all of the ag schools are funded by big agribusiness. And how do you have a welcoming, because we can't afford to lose any family farms, conventional or organic. You know, how do we address that tension and have it be an invitation to take a look and to do things like make sure if legislation, like we've got Prop 1 going in, which will be cage-free chickens and no gestation crates for pigs in January in California. But we realized when that proposition passed, we had to protect our farmers and ranchers and a lot of our conventional chicken guys who were going to have to spend a lot of money to revamp. So we had legislation that Jared Huffman put forward, and it was bipartisan legislation saying that you can't sell your eggs from another state if you didn't raise them the way we expect these animals to be treated. So that was an example, I think, of a good compromise of, you know, regulation coming in, which could really hurt economically conventional guys, but it was because the people of the state said they wanted it. And then legislation coming behind it saying, okay, you people of the state of California, you say it's inhumane to do this. These farmers are going to change it. And you're not going to be buying eggs here cheap from torture chicken somewhere else. You know, so there's that, as you were saying, how do we shift things and invite in everybody to the table from family farms, even if they've had generations, as you were saying, with the FFA and that kind of thing. So, Severin, that's something that obviously you're working on right now. I see us, I think in Marin, we've done a good job of trying to move through that. I mean, Evan, you might be able to address that, or Aaron, but it is an issue. How do you join the young new farmers together with the young fourth and fifth generation farmers and make them great allies?
I think there's a lot of common ground that everyone can agree on. I mean, there's...
We all agree on beer.
Sorry, what was that?
We all agree on beer.
And Severin says that that's her greatest accomplishment is getting free beer for Grange meetings.
This is true. It's a common occurrence out here in California as well. And, there is a need for a cultural shift around the values that we... Besides beer, the values that we can also all agree on, you know, that, you know, between shifting our notion of commodities to a notion of food, from a market supply to that of local entrepreneurs, which again also means the viability of their businesses and the ability to make ends meet, and then shifting market demand, the sort of abstract notion of market demand, to, you know, our own community. There's a constant back and forth between what we do culturally in our own backyards with how regulation endorses and supports and upholds those values that we have and we express. I think a lot of this, in order to actually put in things like regulation and laws and propositions that are actually going to support and reward the kinds of things that we see as valuable and sustainable in the long run, it's going to have to start with on-the-ground participation. One of the things I was thinking about is, as we're talking a lot about the commons, is that in order to have a successful commons, I think we really first have to start reteaching ourselves how to engage civically, you know, whether it's simply voting in local elections. I'm sure everyone here on this phone call voted in their local elections, but this year it was a quarter of, you know, your population that actually went out to a vote in California. Unfortunately, that was a 10% drop. In voter turnout, and for those of us young whippersnappers under the age of 30, we only comprised about 12% of voters. So in order for us to actually look at how do we change the local culture to affect the regulations, because the regulations are going to follow, you know, they're going to follow consumer demand. The politicians are not leaders. You know, they're followers of those who stand up and say something, those who actually show up to the poll booths.
Well, mostly to lobbyists. I have to interject.
Yeah, Severin, can you talk a little bit about that from a national level? Because what we've seen with the food sovereignty movement is that whether you're a Republican or Democrat, you are pandering to agribusiness lobbyists. You're not really listening to the people.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you, Evan, on engagement. And I'm feeling major solidarity around this conversation about, you know, increasing the complexity. You know, you're talking about the eggs and the standard of those eggs in California rising up and codifying that increase in standard and saying, this is what we do here, and we have a high standard, as opposed to kind of the typical globalization way, which is saying, you know, let's take it however we can get it, the cheapest from anywhere, and yes, we don't mind if our smartphones are made by children in China. And you know, I was talking to my friend who's a rancher, a holistic grazer, and he's just been coming back from a tour of Australia where they don't have the lobbyists, they don't have a subsidy structure for agriculture, and they've also had a 10-year drought. And he said, in the face of that crisis, growers and, you know, ranchers and farmers are far more available and open to reconfiguring the way that they farm and reorienting their agriculture to match the ecosystem and the landscape. And the reduced water and drought is obviously a major shock to the system. But I think that kind of open-mindedness that he's talking about has to be more than the farmer. That open-mindedness and the willingness to engage in, you know, complex legal codes and in reconfiguring our systems, our infrastructure, our roads, our markets, our settlement patterns, that takes all of us. And I think there's more than just the producer and the consumer in that ballet. There are so many others communicating, facilitating, passing knowledge, passing equity, instigating the systems that it will take to transform these places. So it's complicated.
I'm just going to quickly let our listeners know that they're listening to KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley, and you're listening to a collaboration of Post Carbon Radio and the Farm and Food Shed Report. And we want to thank some of our underwriters. Support for KWMR is provided by Cover Girls Upholstery and Point Reyes Station, specializing in full-service upholstery, slipcovers, drapes, cushions, pillows, and fabrics for both indoor and outdoor use. Cover Girls is a priority dealer for Hunter Douglas window coverings and has been recovering West Marin for over 25 years. Mara can be reached at 415-663-9363. We also want to thank the West Marin Pharmacy. Support for KWMR is provided by West Marin Pharmacy, providing traditional and holistic prescription services, offering homeopathic, Chinese, Ayurvedic, and organic herbal products, as well as options for pets. A local source for fax and copy services, office supplies, eco toys and gifts. Appointments are available for medication review and counseling. It's on the corner of 4th and A Streets in downtown Point Reyes Station. You can find out more at 415-663-1121. Severin Von Scharner Fleming has been our guest, along with Evan Wieg and Aaron Wilder. And Severin, you are more than welcome to stay on with us. We got you to agree to an hour, but we have some other farmers joining us as well, and to continue the conversation.
Well, I'll let them take it on. I have a tendency to talk too much. I really enjoy the opportunity, and I hope you guys all check out the upcoming Farm Hack events and upcoming Grange Future Tour starting December 2nd. At the Little Lake Grange and going all the way down to San Diego, grangefuture.org. Bye, everyone.
Thanks a lot, Severin.
Bye.
Now we'd like to bring in our local farmers. Are you on the line, Mickey and Molly?
So,
I am.
Okay.
Oh, great. So,
I am too.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so we've got Mickey, Mullen, Aaron, and
Mickey
Evan.
Merch.
Great. Yeah. Oh, so Molly Meyerson lives in Point Reyes and farms just outside of Tamales, and she's a farmer for Osterias de Lina and also sells to other local restaurants and stores and at the Point Reyes Farmers Market. She has an acre of diversified vegetables, cut flowers, and quail eggs, and great padron peppers. And Mickey Murch is an organic farmer and an artist, and he has Gospel Flat Farm in Bolinas. And Mickey, I think you're second generation farmer there.
That's right.
So I'm going to let you take it away being with our local guys.
Okay. Thanks for joining us. And tell us a little bit about your operation. Maybe start with Molly. Tell us about your farm. It's in Tamales Bay, outside of Tamales.
Yeah. 1 acre plot that I lease, and it's Bloomfield area. I'm an all-organic farm, although I'm not certified. I'm registered. And I sell year-round a variety of vegetables, mostly for restaurants. But like Robin said, I sell at the Point Reyes Farmers Market. And this year I built a small farm stand just on Valley Ford Road, which is a busy highway. And so that's been offering me a nice stream of income from people on the street, similar to Mickey's stand. It's honor system and self-serve. And, I do cut flowers, and I have about 130 quail that I raise for their eggs.
Great. How about Mickey? Tell us a little bit about Gospel Flat Farm. Hello.
Mickey, have we got you there?
Hello, Mickey.
Okay, Mickey may have dropped off, but we still have Evan there.
Still here.
Okay, Evan and Molly, and hopefully Mickey will jump back on the call.
Did they just ask for me?
Yeah.
Oh, Mickey, is that you?
Yes, I somehow got cut off.
Oh, great. Thanks for calling back in. Bing was just asking you to tell us a little bit about Gospel Flat.
Yeah, great. So this is a family farm that started in 1980, and my dad moved here with my mom and my brother, and I was born subsequently in the old farmhouse where all my kids are born, and he farmed for a good number of years, and when I was done with college and studied art, I took the reins from him, and he was pretty good at passing that on and letting me make tons of mistakes and teaching me a bit, but also just letting me take the farm and really want to turn it towards more of a local production and not do trucking over the hill. The whole over the hill was like the enemy to me. I didn't want to sell my place there, so sold it on the side of the road. And that turned into a great success, and we've been selling all of our produce at the farm stand, which is on our property, for 8 years now. And so it's been a really good adventure. And
Mickey, you there? There you are.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. And it's been a great adventure, partly.
Oops, it's still cutting in and out. Are you on a cell phone?
No, I'm on a cheap phone.
You're on a sustainable, affordable phone.
Yes. Well, just hate to buy things over and over and over.
Well, that's a good thing.
Well, hopefully I'll be able to converse with you. The farm stand was so successful that the first couple years we had it, it was heartbreaking when we ran out of produce in around Thanksgiving. We sold every little leaf that we could possibly produce and every potato, and it just was amazing to see the demand that was out there for an honor system produce. And that caused me to take on leases and about double the size of our growing area, but also, most importantly, to diversify in soil types and to have places where I could plant in the winter. So I'm just taking a little break from planting lettuce, and we're trying to do that year-round production so that we don't let people starve of local food. It's not going to happen this year because we've got enough property where we can just keep planting all sorts of beautiful produce even through these dark winter months, and things just grow beautifully. And so we'll be going on our fourth year of produce for 24 hours a day, every day of the year available on the honor system in Bolinas.
And the honor system is very unique because I had a friend of mine come out to visit with her son, and we said, oh, what was the most exciting thing after 5 days in San Francisco and Marin? And he said, that place where they just trusted you to put the money in the box and you got all that food, that your farm stand totally boggled his mind.
And that's where my work as an artist, I kind of feel like what I'm doing as a farm is a social sculpture, and everyone can participate, and anyone who drives by on the road is part of our social sculpture, and it really does blow people's mind. And we didn't even really know that it was going to work in the beginning. It was just a way to get rid of those extra cabbages. I didn't want to truck the produce, so let's just put it on the side of the road and maybe we'll make a profit. So I didn't really think of myself as a businessman, but it's amazing just how well the honor system works. And, you know, our business has taken off, and now I'm in that point in my business where I think, okay, what do I invest in? How do I spend money on the farm? And so we're thinking, okay, well, do you buy land? But I can get land by leasing it for so cheap that land around here is so inflated in the price. It's like, no, I'm not going to go into debt in order to get land whereas I can lease it for $100 a year. And that's kind of a leasing land has just really been a beautiful thing for us. And so very appreciative of all of the different ways that can happen. Have a lease with Public Utilities District, and it was land that was full of invasives and homeless camps and lots of trash, and we went in there and pulled out all of these invasive shrubs and cleared the land, and we didn't even know really that the soil was going to be as beautiful as it is. And we added dump trucks, loads of compost, and that's the winter gardens. I have leases where it's a trade with a neighbor, so they can have free food at the farm stand all year round, and I can plow up their little patch. So there's just so many ways to get that land, and it's really a matter of figuring out ways to make farming not boring and make it efficient, and that's where sort of a sculptural aspect of what I do is to build some tools and do that definite farm hack on the kind of ways we grow. So that's been a lot of fun.
I'd like to ask our young farmers, maybe starting with you, Molly, what are some of the challenges you're facing?
Well, I think that for me personally, I have to lease my land, and I'm not able to do that where I live. So I'm a little envious of Mickey that he gets to live on his farm. For me, I have to drive half an hour. I love living in Point Reyes. I love the community. All of my friends are there. But I couldn't find land, or the place that I found to farm was outside of Tamales. And I'm really lucky to be on the spot that I am because we have a really great well and the soil is great and the people I lease from are wonderful. But the commute really does have an impact. An extra hour a day of just driving that I could be farming is definitely felt. And there's something about being able to live on your farm and have a lifestyle that's that closely integrated when you have a system as integrated as the one that I try to have, where you're producing your waste, goes into the compost and feeds the plants, and there are animals on the property that need attention every day, and just being able to walk out and notice the little things, to be able to live there and have that kind of closeness would definitely be a benefit. So I guess what it boils down to is land access. We're really lucky out in West Marin that there's a really supportive community, and I think if you're involved in the community and able to stay connected locally like Mickey's done and like Aaron Wilder has done, you find a lot of generosity with the people who live there and who own land, if you're lucky enough to be able to do that. So that's been a challenge for me. Another challenge that I have, which hasn't been too much of a problem, is the regulation. I'd like to be certified organic because for a lot of people that label really means something. I can't sell my produce at the Good Earth because that's one standard that they hold to very strictly is all of their produce vendors have to be certified. And I understand when we're looking at a community on a larger scale, like all of Marin, those kinds of governing bodies are important because not everyone can know their farmer. But for someone who's on a small, such a small scale as I am, the costs for certifying are really prohibiting. So I am lucky to have people who know me and I sell within my small community, and that's worked out really well because I can tell them that I'm organic and they know me and that I have integrity, and that works. But it would be nice if there was a way to have more local regulation that actually meant something to consumers that weren't necessarily personal acquaintances.
And maybe Evan and Aaron can address from some of your work with the Farmers Guild and what's going to be coming up, what you guys are also seeing as common challenges to our farmers in our food shed.
Go ahead, Evan.
Well, I think, you know, Molly certainly hit upon the number one challenge for most young farmers, which is land access. Land prices in California are high and continuing to skyrocket. Competition for land, whether that be in agriculture or housing developments or in more profitable plants, depending on where you are in Northern California, you're essentially competing against those who want to buy land for grapes or those who want to buy it for cultivation of weed. And those are two incredibly high profit margin crops, which can't even compare to growing basic foods. You simply can't get the price, the margin on a bunch of carrots that you can on a bottle of wine from Sonoma County, for instance. But the other challenge is access to capital. For a lot of these small farmers, they're out looking for, just to start a season. They need upfront cash, and that's incredibly hard to come by when you're going to a bank and you're going there, and all you have really to put on collateral is your pitchfork or whatever and your good word. But to try to even get a loan from a bank is incredibly challenging for a new farmer who's going into something that isn't necessarily the most economically viable of uses of land when you could be building condos or growing wine.
You know, Evan,
there are two opportunities out there.
There was, I know recently, I think it was Bleeding Heart Cheese that got one of those loan grants from Whole Foods. I believe it was Whole Foods that does those. And they were talking about how they have all this equipment and everything all built out, and they went to the local bank to see if they could get a loan because they needed to fill orders. You know, they've been successful. They've got money. They had standing orders, and they wouldn't consider farm equipment or any of their expensive cheese-making equipment as collateral or as something of value because we just don't even have it in our systems anymore, where it was probably there 75 years ago that you had local banks investing in the farmers. Is that kind of correct? And is there anything happening with, say, any of the credit unions, or is there something within the Young Farmer Movement of trying to get financial institutions more involved?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now we've actually been in contact with the Grange Credit Union about figuring out ways that there can be more access to capital to small farmers given their financial circumstances. We hope to continue those conversations to really have them sit down and kind of look at the situation of many of these young farmers who are entering into this this career. But the other example that I really want to promote is something called Kiva Zip. Now, Kiva Zip is a crowdfunding lending service, and a lot of people are familiar with things like Kickstarter. And this is similar in that way that it's community based and anyone can participate. However, the difference is that it's not giving donations. So you're not crowdsourcing donations so you can get your tractor. You are actually asking for loans. As a small business, you're asking for loans from individual regular people like you and me. Yesterday, I myself, who is definitely in no financial circumstance to lend money in any other traditional lending service. I lent $25 to Mendocino Organics, which is a farm that raises pasture-raised pigs and meats and vegetables up towards Ukiah. And I was able to do that by simply going on to Kiva Zip and lending that service. They then get enough people to lend for the amount they need to raise. In the case of there, they're buying out the pigs from a local farmer who's liquidating their assets. And it's an incredible opportunity that you pretty much bypass the bank. I mean, obviously, I don't know if these kind of loans would work for someone who's looking for, you know, to buy a house or buy a piece of property. But if you're looking to get that, you know, 10, 15 grand that's going to get you started for the first season for equipment, for a new tractor, for whatever that might be, it's a great opportunity. And the Farmers Guild has just become an official trustee, which means we can now vet any of the farmers that we work with by saying this is a good, upstanding, intelligent, hardworking farmer who is deserves the support of the community. And anyone can then go on and lend to them. So if you haven't already checked it out, check out Kiva Zip. You can put in, $5. You can lend $5, or you can get a group of people together. You can get your neighborhood together. You can get your office together. I actually heard a story about some folks at an office who just had a little jar on their counter, and every day people would just put a couple bucks in, $5 here, $5 there, and then when they filled up the jar, they would figure out who to invest it into using Kiva Zip. So it's just a really cool opportunity to bypass the bank and go straight to the community and have people lending to people. So there are some ways to get around some of the obstacles, but of course it still is a huge challenge for young folks getting into the agriculture.
That sounds great. We're looking, excuse me, my wife and I are interested in investing in our community, and that sounds like a great way to help young farmers out getting started.
I know we had that success story with Marissa Thornton wanting to get some Jersey cows on her property because they had to sell off their cows when her grandfather passed away, and she used I can't remember. I think it was Kickstarter, but she used an online campaign. It was not a loan, but that worked very well for her. So once again, coming back to that whole thing of technology and the shift in connections, how we connect is something that you young farmers have that wasn't there before. And, maybe you want to address a little bit about that and about, I know from having talked to some of you before, that coming together and being able to have saying, I've got this extra or I need this, who's got that. Maybe you guys could discuss that a little bit about how you guys are coming together as a supportive group.
Well, just the question of what are some of the challenges for young farmers now. One of the challenges for me was just learning how to farm and I had, a lot of education and apprenticeships, and when I started farming, I thought I knew how to farm, or I thought I knew what I was doing, but it actually has taken years to learn even the basics to know how to actually create a viable economic farm, and I think that having that intergenerational knowledge exchange can be of such an incredible benefit that maybe people might take that even for granted, that some of the techniques and technologies and things like that might just be common sense or something from someone who is an established older generation or generational farmer who's maybe learned it from day one when they were born, walking around on the farm when they were 5 years old or something and just observing. I did get a lot of that from talking to farmers who are still farming, even though they're 70, 80 years old, that it's real easy. It's common sense. Why would you go to college to learn how to farm? That kind of thing. And so one of the challenges, I think, would be just having that established community of older farmers and younger farmers and everyone in between. So that there is an easier way to communicate and discuss challenges and problem solve, and not only the challenges of the technology and things like that, but some of the social challenges are really important. I, I've I've heard stories and known people who have started farms and quit because they just felt isolated or that it wasn't fulfilling them socially. They didn't get the sense of gratification of knowing who was buying their produce and enjoying it because for whatever reason they were far away from that community of people who were consuming it. And I'm personally really lucky to live in a very supportive community in Point Reyes and have the farms there. But I know that just that sense of isolation can be a difficult problem for farmers. And that I think that having a farm guild or at least a community meeting place where farmers can get together regularly and discuss, you just hang out and have a beer together, but also hear from other farmers in the area, from, you know, county extension agent or whatever, talking about the drought or just that kind of thing can be really helpful. And a lot of the relationships that are formed and the real substance that comes out of those meetings isn't as much of what is learned during, you know, a speaker coming and talking or something like that. But from my experience, seems to be just what you do before all that happens. You know, just meeting up with somebody and saying, "Oh, hey, I haven't seen you in a long time. How's it going?" Get introduced to somebody else, and those kind of interactions are totally vital for a lot of younger generation farmers. But I also think that in the established farming community, it's kind of taken for granted that they're just friends have, you know, other friends, and there's networks that are established
because they all grew up together and kind of knew each other.
Right. Yeah. So how do you, you know, reach out and create more network and connections socially amongst a lot of the agrarian people, ranching community, and crop farming, and across the spectrum.
Mickey or Molly, you have anything to add?
That was making me think of...
Oh, Mickey, I was just going to remind you of when I did the story for Edible Marin and Wine Country on love on the farm, how hard it was to find love and dates. And I think I had a picture of you and your wife as a successful match. But that was something that Molly, I don't know if any of you guys want to address that too. It's also about how do you socialize and how do you date? Because farmers are kind of the new rock stars, and you think, oh, how easy. But when you tell somebody, oh, you know, I have to get up at 4 a.m., and if you want to go have a glass of wine at 5, my hands are going to be dirty, and I need to go to bed by 9. So that's also, you know, you needing each other because you understand each other. Can you guys address that, Molly, Mickey, a little bit?
Well, I mean, I know from person. Go ahead, Molly.
Well, I'm not married, and I know that that's been just the social aspect of farming is something I think about a lot. I'm not really interested. I started the farm alone. This year I have a woman who works with me 3 days a week, but between the two of us, it's just us or just me by myself. And it can feel a little isolating, and I'm a social person. One of the things I think about and challenges that I've given to myself is to try to make farming just more of a regular job than the kind of marriage to the farm that it's traditionally been. I'd like to have some time in the evening that I feel like I can socialize and not have to wake up before the sun comes up. It is a lot of work, so I'm not sure if that goal is totally attainable, but I think I feel like I've been pretty good at it, and it's what's going to make farming workable for me as a long-term occupation, is that I'm able to retain a social life as well as have a productive farm.
Mickey, do you have anything to add to that, or Evan?
Well, sure. Our farm stand is this kind of there's an explosion of people and social things going on, and sometimes we just have to duck out because you could just be trapped over there talking to everybody you know and everyone you're about to meet. And so that's what's great about not checking every person out. You can just do a little work and keep your head down and then go back and into the field, and people continue to shop on their own. And it would be really tricky to, I mean, sometimes for us, we just have to kind of curb the amount of guests that we have on the farm, and it's, which is a great problem to have. It's nice to have so many friends around, and I'm driving down the road, and basically I wave at every car going by. It makes me really feel like part of the community, and I don't think I could achieve that if I wasn't a farmer. So really feeling like I feed a lot of people in our community, and that's just so righteous, and I'm so thankful for everybody that they eat our food. And as far as life with kids and with a beautiful family and a wife, it's just been really amazing to, like Molly said, I'm really lucky that I get to work at home. And instead of commuting, I drive a tractor to a various lease. And there's just a lot of time to be with family. And I'm lucky that I get to live here. So I just feel it's hard for me to really speak on the challenges of that because it's going pretty well. We have three kids, and it's definitely a full life. You know, you end up doing a lot, and then bring the kids along. You already have a job, but they want to come too, and so that makes you go even slower. Slow is fast, as some people have proved. So, yeah.
You know, Mickey, can you hearkening back to what you said before, it sounded like you had a nice kind of growth trajectory where you had some early success and then you were able to sort of add on a patch here and a lease there. But it makes me think, I want to get back to the really basics of each of you, how you got started and why you got started. What brought you to it? And if somebody was listening and thinking, you know, that sounds like fun, I'm not sure I want to, you know, jump in whole hog, no pun intended, but what would you say to somebody who's thinking about getting started?
Well, I love to show people around my farm. I just take so much pleasure in that. I think a lot of farmers really don't feel so possessive about the way they've set up their farm. They actually want to share that, and they sort of want someone else to copy what they did, kind of verification. And I really copied a lot what other farmers did. So, you know, tour around your neighbor. You know, wherever you're going to farm, look at the nearest farm and try to learn as much as you can. And I certainly have done that. And it's just basically a matter of copy and pasting and figuring out what works in your area. And, you know, also I feel like there's a little bit of discouragement with everyone was saying that, the carrots aren't going to compete on the grapes. Well, I don't know. We can get carrots, a lot of bunches out of a bed of carrots. I'm not so sure about that. And I just try to encourage people to find a way to sell, get the whole value for your crop. And that's, you know, selling retail. And that, it just doubles your profits right away. And also trying to make it so you don't have to drive a lot to deliver all your produce. And if you can figure out a way to do that, then there's already so much more money in your pocket when you go to sell your produce. So keep your expenses low in terms of filling up your delivery truck with diesel. That was my dad's biggest expense. It was every time he wanted to sell produce, it was driving to the South San Francisco. Ah, that's a lot of gas.
Well, I'm going to hop in and just thank some of our local sponsors. And one of the things, as you guys are talking about, we're really lucky that we're not living like in the valley where we're way isolated. So we're living in a wonderful grouping of communities. And we want to thank some of our underwriters here. So KWMR, supported by the Bear Valley Inn, a turn-of-the-century bed and breakfast, a green business serving local and organic ingredients in continental breakfast. Rates and availability can be discovered, found out about, at 415-663-1777. Or you can go online to bearvn.com. That's bear like the animal, V as in Victor, INN.com. We also want to thank Point Reyes Books. Local programming is provided by our listener members and by Point Reyes Books, offering a wide selection of books, magazines, greeting cards, and author events. The bookstore offers gift certificates and special orders on the web at pointreyesbook.com. And that's P-T-Reyes, R-E-Y-E-S, books.com. You're listening to KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. And this is a collaboration of Post Carbon Radio and the Farm and Food Shed Report. I think one of our hosts here, Corinne has a question.
Yeah, just a follow-up. Thanks, Mickey, for that response, and I'm interested in hearing from all of you if you care to. I'm just going to throw something out for your comment, which is a word I invented, which is fardening. It's a cross somewhere between gardening and farming where you've got a little bit more land than you need to grow food for your own kitchen, but and you might do it with other people. I live in Petaluma. I'm on my third opportunity of growing in someone else's yard, which might be a residential backyard or might be as big as 1 or 2 acres. There are a lot of plots. I see parcels in Petaluma area where nobody's growing, but there's a lot of land. There might be half an acre, 2 acres. And it's all a matter, it seems to me, of knowing somebody. And then you get an opportunity. Half those places have wells. And, you know, then it's only a question of how much time you can put in. And get going. And then pretty soon you've got more crops than you need. The way I do it or have been doing it is, you know, we don't get involved in the market. We get our friends and we grow for ourselves. And I don't know that I'm going to end up being a farmer. I envy and admire all of you. But I wonder if you have any comments about sort of starting that organic way. Did any of you have experiences or know of situations like that?
Well, I think, Mickey, you had talked a little bit about how it can be a win-win situation between the owners of the land and and yourself as a farmer, in that, you know, the BPUD property maybe was kind of neglected and there was a lot of litter there maybe and invasive weeds, and now it's a productive place where food is grown and the weeds aren't there and, you know, the trash isn't dropping or whatever. And so there's a lot of synergies that can happen between the landowner and the farmer, and not only that, but the community. Like you said, Karin, you can grow food for your community, and that solves one of the big problems of food distribution and transport.
I just want to let me just check and see if John Wick is joined us yet. John, are you with us? You were expecting John.
I'm standing by. There's a very very engaging conversation. So
we asked John Wick, who's the co-founder of the Marin Carbon Project and a tireless advocate for that, to join us just to talk a little bit. I hate to cut us short on that, but we wanted to set some time to talk about soil science and the innovations that are happening that make farming such, if it's done correctly, such an amazing environmental asset. So, John, would you like to start just a little bit on that? And that you don't hear that much about soil science. You don't hear it in the greater mainstream dialogue about the young farmers movement.
No, and the important thing here is the Marin Carbon Project and our entire effort is focused on a scientific understanding of carbon and the carbon cycle and our relationship to it. And agriculture certainly is a carbon cycle management activity. You produce carbohydrates out of carbon dioxide. That's your job, and you use the sun to do that. Our original inquiry, though, however, focused on grazed rangelands, and we did that very intentionally. And the idea here is that rather than row crops and arable systems, which you guys are enjoying working in, our focus was entirely on grazed rangeland systems because there's evidence that those systems are crashing on their own now. They've become a source of greenhouse gas emissions. And through different events that had happened on my ranch and by working with scientists, we had a couple of observations that provided insights that resulted in the Marin Carbon Project and the research that we've conducted, where we have demonstrated scientifically now that we can ship massive quantities of carbon from the atmosphere through the production of carbohydrates in the form of grasses and plants. And some of that carbon ends up beneficially in the soil system in a more long-lasting form than the plants themselves. What's important here is that these mechanisms and our understanding of these mechanisms in soil system management will also apply to arable lands. We haven't gone there yet scientifically, and so it's really important that people eat and have food, and farmers are doing good, hard work, and we need to support that, and I really enjoyed it. I was listening to the whole show, and it's very exciting, all the conversation. We're not yet there in terms of looking at arable land carbon cycle management. We know a tremendous amount now about rangeland and are very excited about what that means. And I don't know, does that open up more questions than provides background?
Well, I know that Aaron had talked about this before, too. And Aaron, I think, don't you have a background in soil science?
I have a degree in rangeland resource management and wildland soil science. And I was just mentioning, John, before the talk that back in the late 90s when I got my degree, one of the largest funding, public funding places was around carbon sequestration. And I was working after I graduated with the government in the U.S. Forest Service. And I asked, why don't policy people make management decisions as much based on the soil surveys and the soil veg surveys that we're putting together on the rangelands? And they said, the answer was, well, soil science isn't really sexy. And agriculture, right now is a hot topic. And I think this is a really prime time to be talking about carbon sequestration, especially with greenhouse gas emissions and everything. And just as a place to as a topic of discussion, that it seems like time is ripe right now for this to be happening.
And so, is there interest in looking more at also arable land? I mean, I know, John, with what you guys did, it was like by putting down a very small amount of compost over the land that it was able to make an amazing difference. It seems very likely that a lot of that would transfer over to looking at how you're managing your crops.
Yeah, there most likely is a direct transfer of that. The approach that we're taking is to understand mechanisms first, which we've got a great understanding on now. We've come to understand things that were not known in 2008. One of those things was there was a globally assumed loss of carbon to the atmosphere from compost. Most people thought, and including scientists, most people thought that compost, the carbon in compost, oxidized back to the atmosphere, and it wasn't stable. Our research has shown otherwise. I believe the number is something about 90 to 96% of the carbon in the compost that we applied in our research plots has now entered the soil system slowly over time and did not oxidize to the atmosphere. This was actually a surprise to Dr. Silver, our lead investigator. So this was a great thing to understand. Also, we were able to demonstrate that, in fact, management could enhance carbon in soil. Most people, including Dr. Silver in 2008, didn't think it was even possible or measurable. And through our research, we've shown that not only is it measurable, it's significant and it's easy to measure using very standard scientific methodologies. The arable system, however, is challenging because there's tillage involved. And when you till, you're actually breaking apart the physical structure that's protecting fossil carbon, and you're oxidizing that carbon through microorganisms consuming it, but then their waste products become plant-available nutrients, which is why we see a response in plants. But we are burning up fossil carbon. So the question here is, are there agricultural practices that don't require tillage, but rather are additive? And that would be an area of research that we could look at next. For us, the big good news was that there's enough land area currently under management as grazed rangelands that we can have a major benefit by applying carbon back into that system, restoring previous levels through a biologically stable form like compost. And what was very exciting and nobody saw coming was that that single application of compost, 1/2 inch in 2008, has resulted in a state change in these soil systems. And from then on, without any further compost, the treatment plots have been taking in carbon on their own at a ton per hectare per year. A hectare is 2.5 acres. Compared to the control plots right next to them, which were grazed also and are losing carbon. So we're stepping into a system that's crashing, and this is a global phenomenon. And with a single bump of carbon in a stable form, not manure, not mulch, but rather compost, the system turned around and is starting to go in the other direction, becoming a carbon sink on its own now. And I think that's rather sexy, to get to Aaron's point.
So, and really what we're talking about, too, when you talk about the challenges of agriculture and doing it in a regenerative, restorative, and sustainable way, you know, environmentalists have so attacked agriculture for so long that what's happening now, it's not just the passion, but it's also the real sense of using innovation in science.
Yeah, and there's a lot of work to be done. But John, your work has been a watershed event in terms of how we manage the rangelands in our especially public lands, because I think something like 80% of our publicly owned lands are considered rangelands. And while the feasibility of adding compost to that whole area might be questionable, but there may be still a huge benefit. And as you know, you've worked on a lot in incentivizing the management using composting practices and in intensive grazing and rotational grazing and things like that.
Yeah, I need to take a kind of an overview for this. It's very important for everyone to understand it was not our intention or plan to put compost on grazed rangelands as a practice. It was a scientific question. Can we get an increase in soil carbon? And through several processes, we ended up with a simple idea. Let's put carbon on the top of the soil and see what happens. And that the best form of that carbon was compost. And we hit a grand slam. We knocked it out of the park. This was a wonderful, exciting outcome. But really what our scientific pursuit is now focusing on is the meta question, using a global circulation modeling exercise to determine which natural system has the capacity to lower Earth's temperature 1°C. And that's what's important here, that we've shown a mechanism and that works really well in a system, grazed rangeland systems. How does that mechanism also work in arable or forest or urban soils? Those are all their important questions. But now we're backing away and asking the bigger question. Now that we've got some insight into these systems, what system under management can actually affect the change we need to reverse the climate crisis? And so we're going in that direction, and then simultaneously looking into the actual composting process and looking at the greenhouse gas that's developed during composting and perfecting the compost methodology so that we can achieve the least amount of greenhouse gas emissions for the most soil beneficial compost formula, and then look at the different systems that we put that in. And so scientifically, we're looking at the meta question about the global circulation model potential of these things. And then the next thing that needs to be identified is the first and best use of these organic waste streams. So there's a comparative life cycle assessment exercise that's one of our pursuits right now, looking at all available organic feedstocks. Anything that was ever alive should and can be composted. And the question is, what are all those feedstocks? Where are they? What are the processes? And the processes include rotting, which is a greenhouse gas source, composting, which we've gotten great insight into, anaerobic biodigestion, and then perhaps composting the product of that. And then there are other processes such as biochar and incineration. So comparing all of those processes with all of the feedstocks and then looking at the fates, the grazed rangeland, arable, forest, and urban soil systems, and identifying what the first and best use of these available resources are to help solve what we consider the most important problem, which is removing carbon from the atmosphere. And this is actually supported by the recent 2013 IPCC assessment, where the first paragraph says that basically we are past the threshold now where emission reductions will no longer have an effect on the crisis. And then the next paragraph is, the only thing we can do now is remove carbon from the atmosphere. And this is really supportive of our work. Our work has shown that we can remove massive quantities of carbon from the atmosphere. And what we've seen now in our grazed rangeland systems is you do that once through compost application, you've primed the system, and from then on, it becomes a removal process, where from then on, that soil takes in more and more and more carbon from the atmosphere. And the good news is the composted plots, when we analyze the grass produced on them, it's more nutritious. And the water holding capacity is really huge. We measured 26,000 liters more water per hectare, 2.5 acres, from a half inch of compost. And that seems to go on for year after year after year. And the computer model shows this continuing for 30 years. At about year 17, we start seeing a diminishing effect. But that suggests that in systems like in California, where we've lost most of our soil carbon from a shift to annual species and 200 years of grazing history, we can now start restoring carbon back into those systems. And Aaron, you said it would be hard to get compost out on all that landscape. But we could certainly start where the landscape is near compost centers or urban centers, while we're also asking that question about farming and how to start working with farming systems managing for carbon there.
Well, John, oh, go ahead, Bing, you had a question.
Yeah, I just, that's all great news. And I wanted to give Aaron an opportunity to tell us about the forum that he's organizing coming up in January with young farmers and experienced farmers, right?
Yeah, well, I've been working with Evan on this, actually. Are you still there, Evan?
I sure am.
Oh, good. We've been working on having discussions around the topic of how can we create a more vibrant agricultural community in West Marin by working with more agriculturalists in West Marin and having what would that look like and how can we do that? And we started out trying to work with area organizations who are already working on that subject of and we thought, well, one of the kind of levers that might shift some of the discussion might be around how working with established farmers and landowners and finding ways that the existing methods that are being used right now, such as grazing, might be paired up with some kind of method, either grazing or rotational cropping or something like that, that can increase the productivity of the landscape and while also creating more economic, increasing the agricultural economy in West Marin and achieving the end goal, which is to invigorate the agricultural community by creating more of these networks and partnerships between landowners and farmers. And so after about a year of having discussions on a regular basis with different folks from people who are working on these topics in on the organizational level to ranchers and farmers who are working every day on their ranches and farms to organizers interested in this. We decided that probably a good place to start would be just to have a meeting. So our working title for our conversation about this topic is Succession and Success, Beginning a Conversation About the Future of the Marin Landscape. And really it's just to bring people to the table to have a lot of people who are concerned about that, but also landowners and people in the ranching community and farming community here in West Marin and in Marin proper to be all in one room together talking about what the future of our agricultural landscape is going to be like in Marin, given that Marin is one of the highest property values in the nation for a rural area, and that there's also incredible wealth here to potentially support the creation of a long-term agricultural economy here if that's what's desired, rather than what earlier on in our conversation, some of the things that Severin was saying was that in the future we might see an increased consolidation of agricultural land into smaller and smaller hands of more wealthy individuals or corporations and out of away from agriculture. And one of the concerns is that in West Marin, some of the agricultural land may not end up as agricultural land. And we want to, as young farm, as people in the young farming community, We would like to see that land stays as agricultural land, and that it doesn't just become a place where, you know, where it's a kind of a sanctuary for, you know, not agriculture to happen, or, you know, where people can.
Let me go ahead into this space here. It's really important to you guys. I understand about farming and I understand about ranching, and it seems to me a very important difference between the two is water. Grazed rangelands exist because of the type of vegetation that occurs naturally, and farming, as you guys use it it requires water. And I know on my ranch, I don't have adequate water to grow row crops. So then there's a natural history of grazing animals walking across my landscape. So that's a pretty good fit.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to always keep track that we don't confuse farming and ranching, because farming is water intensive.
Mm-hmm.
I would also like Aaron to tell us when and where and your keynote speakers that you're planning to have.
Conversation is going to happen in Nicasio, at the Nicasio Druids Hall, in late January. We haven't picked an actual date, but it'll either be the January 24th or the 25th. Some of the keynote speakers will be Severin will be speaking on the topic of the past and the present and the future situation of farming and ranching, and what the next generation might look like nationwide. And for the Marin perspective and overall perspective, we've been in conversation with Ralph Grossi to be the keynote speaker for that. We're having some success stories being discussed, some of the relationships that have formed between landowners and farmers and ranchers. So there'll be some slideshows and presentations on that, and then there'll be a panel discussion between younger farmers and ranchers and the older generation farmers and ranchers, as well as some of the landowners who have actually partnered with farmers and ranchers in West Marin.
Great.
And will this be open to the public?
Of course, yeah. Everybody is invited to come. We'll put an official notice out in the papers and post in the post office and things like that once we're ready.
Great. I think we're going to have to wrap it up. I wish we had more time to get some final words from everyone.
I just want to thank everybody. And John, thank you for calling in. And we covered a wide range of things. Thank you. I think Mickey may still be there, and Molly and Evan. And thank you to Bing Gong, whose idea this was.
Actually, I asked Aaron to produce the show, and he came up with Severin and Evan to join us. And anyway, thank you, Aaron, for setting this up.
And welcome to Curran, who I just got to meet, Bing's new co-host. So thank you all. And I think we've... thanked everybody. It's going to be exciting. I know Bing's show and Curran's show and my show will let you guys know about the upcoming event in January, and we'll be keeping you informed. And thank you for listening.
And good luck to all you young farmers.
Thanks.
Yes, thank goodness for all of you.
Yes, you're our future.